coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The First State named its 2019 Teacher of the Year this week.
I am overwhelmed and I was very surprised. I was able to listen and watch the videos of the other candidates and I just could admire them. They represent the very best of Delaware and I just feel blessed to be among them.
Our Sophia Schmidt chats with Dana Bowe, a special education teacher at West Seaford Elementary School. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also have a new arts playlist examining a documentary detailing the Kalmar Nichols colonial voyage to what would become the First State. Plus, the latest edition of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A Matter of Facts, focused on education. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Delaware Department of Education named its 2019 Teacher of the Year this week. The honor goes to Dana Bowe, a special ed elementary teacher in Seaford. Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt caught up with Bowe this week to discuss her teaching philosophy and what she's learned in her 17 years as an educator.
Newly announced Teacher of the Year, Dana Bowe teaches kindergarten through second grade for the Sussex County Orthopedic Program at West Seaford Elementary School. I talked to her the day after her win was announced and asked her how she was feeling.
Well, I am overwhelmed and I was very surprised. I was able to listen and watch the videos of the other candidates and I just could admire them, each and every one of them. They represent the very best of Delaware, and I just feel blessed to be among them. I felt very grateful, feel just very grateful, the outpouring of support and love from the families here at West Seaford and all of the staff and just everyone around the school district has been outstanding. The kids came in very excited. It's been a pretty special day.
Before coming to the Sussex County Orthopedic Program at West Seaford, Bowe taught at several public schools in Delaware and one in Denver, Colorado.
I actually was a kindergarten teacher or a first grade teacher. And when I was at Blades Elementary teaching kindergarten, I started taking my master's in special education and got my certification from Wilmington University in severe disabilities and autism. And from there, a position became available in the Sussex County Orthopedic Program, which was at another school, which was at Central. And I got the job there, and it's just been a fantastic experience.
One of the things you're being recognized for is building an atmosphere of inclusion and respect at your school. And I'm wondering if you can just kind of detail for me some of the ways that you've done that.
Yes. Well, my message is about inclusion. It's awareness and acceptance for all individuals with special needs. But more than that, it's really appreciating those who might seem a little different or learn a little different than us. My students are my inspiration, but they also inspire so many other kids. Here at West Seaford, we're part of Spread the Word. It's the Cool Schools Challenge, which is part of Special Olympics Unified Sports Teams. We are spreading the word respect. We read books about respecting others. You know, the other regular education teachers also practice inclusion. Some of my students are pulled out into my special education classroom, but they push into regular education classrooms. So they're making friends and they're having breakfast or they're maybe reading, shared reading with regular education students, which is great language experience, great friendships. It's building friendships for both special education students as well as the regular education students. We also participate in things like the polar bear plunge, and I participate in things like the buddy walk, just promoting awareness for all students, no matter what their label or their disability is.
What kind of drove you to go into education in the first place? Did you always know you wanted to? And in particular, why did you want to go into special education?
Well, My parents are both educators. Both of my parents were teachers here in the Seaford School District. And I knew I always wanted to be a teacher. I went to college at East Carolina University and studied elementary education. And I considered special education, but at that time you had to pick which specialty that you wanted to go under. And I wasn't sure, and I just continued with elementary ed. But in the back of my heart, in the back of my mind, I always knew that I was very interested in special education. When I was a middle school student at Seaford Middle School, I remember students coming in wheelchairs and braces, and I remember the love and the passion that their teachers and their paras had for those students and just the care that they always gave them with such dignity. And it inspired me so much. I finally got the nerve up to go back to school to get my master's degree from Wilmington University in special education, and I'm just so blessed to have this job and work with such amazing teachers and paraprofessionals and therapists. This is just a wonderful place to work.
Once you got into the field of special education, working in it, was there anything that surprised you, or what have you learned from your students?
Well, you have to constantly be learning. Each child is different, and each of their needs are different. So it's important that I constantly am researching and talking to therapists and reaching out for other resources to make sure each child is successful.
What is the hardest part of being a teacher?
The hardest part is that you never stop thinking about your students. The hardest part is sometimes you wake up in the middle of the night and you're trying to find a new way, a better way to teach to make sure each child is successful.
So I guess with that in mind, what advice would you give young teachers who are just starting out in the field?
Always teach with your heart. Make sure that you are treating each child as if they're your own. Do your very best for each and every child. And it's okay to make mistakes, but I think really perseverance and learning to make sure that every child gets everything they need to make sure every child is successful is most important. And sometimes you have to think outside the box. Sometimes you have to think on the spot. Planning's important, but you have to be prepared for each day, because each day in education is a new adventure.
I'd love to hear you sort of flesh out some examples from your experiences. Are there specific teaching techniques that you've either, you know, learned from talking with others, or that you've just kind of learned by doing, whether that's, you know, classroom activities or ways of communicating with your students, ways of talking with parents and getting them engaged?
Oh, yes. Parents are my biggest, they are advocates. They are my support system. We're truly partners in education. As for special education, they know their students. So when a child comes to me new, I love talking to the parents to find out what they like, how I can inspire them, how I can get them engaged in my classroom, to find out what their likes are, and make sure that their best learning style is the way that I'm teaching for them. I have students that use assistive technology, such as I had a student who used an iPad talker, which is like a speech generating device, and just getting him motivated to use that. It took some time, and some days are hard, but once they see success, and once you see success and they are communicating with you, it is an unbelievable and wonderful, wonderful success.
Thinking a little bit more broadly, you've taught in a couple different schools in and out of Delaware.
Yeah.
What would you, like, if you had power to change the education system in Delaware, what are some things that you think we need to improve on? Where would you focus?
The truth is, Delaware is doing a wonderful job. I hear from other parents who are part of advocacy groups that talk about other states, and I feel so blessed to teach in Delaware and to teach in Seaford, where we are making sure that our students get everything they need. They receive therapies at school. They are part of a regular education classroom. They're getting small group instruction if they need it. We make sure that every child is growing socially, cognitively. Everything that they need, we try to provide for them. And parents are great supporters. We are very lucky here.
with this this honor of being Teacher of the Year comes some funding, which I understand partially is to be put back toward your students, and sort of just like a broader platform with which to communicate with, you know, other teachers, legislators, that kind of thing. Tell me a little bit about how you're planning to use this platform and these additional resources.
Well, my platform is inclusion. It's awareness and acceptance for individuals with special needs, but more than that, it's really appreciation for those who might seem a little different. My students they're my inspiration. Each and every one of them is capable of such greatness. And so now it's really about sharing their greatness with others. The funding, this is all very overwhelming and in the best kind of way. Really, we're going to talk about and probably discuss how we can use the funding to promote awareness and promote inclusion here in the Seaford School District.
That's Dana Bowe, Delaware's 2019 Teacher of the Year. And I'm Sophia Schmidt for Delaware Public Media.
Thanks to Delaware's Teacher of the Year, Dana Bowe, and our Sophia Schmidt for joining us on The Green this week. Next, a new arts playlist with more on a Kalmar Nichol documentary recently nominated for a Mid-Atlantic Emmy Award. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The documentary Kalmar Nichol, The Forgotten Journey was recently nominated for a 2018 Mid-Atlantic Emmy. The documentary about the Swedish colonial ship that landed in Delaware was filmed on the Delaware Bay using the full-scale replica of the Kalmar Nichol that calls Wilmington home. The documentary depicts the voyage that launched the colony of New Sweden in the Delaware Valley. Sam Heat is the Kalmar Nichol Foundation's senior historian and director of education. He's also the documentary's executive producer. In this week's Arts Playlist, he speaks with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about the documentary.
Explain this title. What does it mean? Why is it The Forgotten Journey?
Great question. That's a great place to begin. There are really two aspects to The Forgotten Journey, and it's something that we wanted to... it was a way for us as a tall ship and a maritime educational organization to be able to make a contribution to Delaware's history, Delaware Valley's history, and America's colonial history. So the first forgotten journey is the broad Atlantic crossing. It's a huge Atlantic world. It's a huge story. It's all of the 17th century and the 18th century colonial experiences. Everyone crossed the Atlantic. And you can include Africa, too, if you want. We don't in our story, but certainly the African slave trade. Everyone crossed the Atlantic who immigrated to North America. And we've lost a sense of how difficult that passage was and how dangerous it was and what it took to bring these ships, what kind of ships they were, and how they navigated and how they made it from Europe, let's say, to North America. So that was the first part. And I could elaborate a little more on that, but let me just mention the other one is the Swedish experience. We're a Swedish ship. Delaware, the first permanent settlement in European settlement in Delaware and the Delaware Valley was Fort Christina, a Swedish colonial settlement. So the Swedes were here in the Delaware Valley establishing themselves before any other European power. And in America broadly, but even in the Delaware Valley and even in Delaware, we don't have a good sense that the Swedes were here. The Swedes? Who, really? The Swedes had an empire? The Swedes had a navy? The Swedes had a North American colony? This is something that doesn't really fit our mental picture of America's colonial period. So back to the Atlantic. I mean, the Atlantic was a first frontier. It was an experience that everyone shared in the colonial experience. It took about 3 months to cross from Europe to America. With the prevailing winds, it was a little shorter going back, usually about 2 months, but that's if things went well. And things didn't always go well on the first Kalmar Nichol voyage. And the Kalmar Nichol, I should add to your audience, made four round-trip crossings. more than any other colonial ship of the era. And so we're proud of that record of endurance. So that's 8 transatlantic crossings successful from Sweden to New Sweden. But the crossing, you know, took a long time. It was dangerous. The best records we have come from the 18th century and not the 17th century. But the loss rate was about 20% in the 18th century, and one can make inferences that it would have been even higher in the 17th century. So if you get in your car today and you knew that commuting from work to home, you had a 20% loss rate, you might think more carefully about commuting that kind of distance. So that's the Atlantic. It shaped, it's the distance from which we are removed from Europe and the time lag, the 3 months, really 5 months, to get a message to America and then have America process that message and then send it back to Europe. That time lag explains America's colonial identity, explains the revolution, explains who we become and how we become a different place. So we've lost a sense of that. I taught American history for 20 years, and we tend to do it at the water's edge, at the beach, and we don't look at it from the ocean. If you turn the map sideways and you come at North America from the Atlantic, everything begins to look differently. So that's that. The other element that we thought we could do and needed to do, we're a Swedish ship by heritage, was to tell the story of the Swedes in the Delaware Valley, at least the initial settlement. We couldn't do all of New Sweden. That was beyond the scope of a one-hour documentary. But we could at least introduce the concept that the Swedes were here, and they had an important role in the development of the Delaware Valley. That leads to interesting questions, because so many people have never heard of New Sweden, don't know that the Swedes had an empire, don't know that they had a navy, don't know that they were interested in North American colonization. It helps us to understand what the other European powers were doing and why they were doing it. If the Swedes are doing it too, it helps us to understand others.
So are these some of the reasons why you produced this documentary?
Yeah. Thank you. We wanted to tell our story of the Kalmar Nickel, a Swedish ship with a Swedish name. It means Key of Kalmar, named for the city of Kalmar in southeastern Sweden, which was an important medieval border fortress and an important early capital in Sweden. And in America, we don't know the city of Kalmar, so we don't even reference that this is a Swedish ship. And that the Swedes were here. So that was one of the things we wanted to do, was tell our story. And the hope was that, you know, a documentary film on television would reach many, many more people. That's my job, is the history and to get the message out. So that was why I sought out that opportunity.
Well, what did you learn from all of this?
Well, that's a good question. The first thing I learned is how hard filmmaking is. You know, there's more that goes on behind the scenes. You hear the stories about, you know, a 30-second commercial took 3 days to film. You hear these things, but until you actually do it, probably like radio, there's an awful lot that goes into producing a quick little 10-minute clip. That's what I learned most of all, was just how difficult and time-consuming and all the challenges one faces in a production that's going to be worth putting on television and worth having people watch it and learn something about it. The other thing I learned, which I had hoped would be true, but I didn't know, that I had hoped that the process of producing a documentary would help discipline the storytelling. One of the challenges we face with the Swedish story and with Dutch investors and Peter Minuit, who was German but worked for the Dutch and had a French Huguenot ancestry, who was our first governor and sort of founding inspiration. It's a very complicated story over in Europe of who's gathering the interest and putting together the investments to start a new colony on behalf of Sweden. Very complicated story, very modern. That's a hard story to tell. I've told it in writing. You know, historians write, and I talk about it a lot. But I saw this as an opportunity to tell our story in a coherent way that, you know, with the power of moving images, nothing like seeing the ship actually sailing out in the ocean, or in our case, we filmed in Delaware Bay. But those compelling images really help the storytelling, and it forces a discipline upon the storyteller, which, of course, is an enormous advantage to the audience. So those are two things I learned.
Let me point this out for our listeners. The documentary initially premiered in December of 2017, and then it re-aired in mid-June this past summer, which is when I saw it. It's fantastic. And the film is now being marketed for an international broadcast and DVD release. When do you expect that it will come out on DVD so that everyone can see it?
Well, we're excited about that. First, let me tell you, we just signed a deal with SVT, which is Swedish Public Television, and so it will be airing in 2019, and then they will air it multiple times, probably 18 or 20 times over the next 3 years. So that's exciting for us that it's an international project. It speaks to Swedes. You know, it's a Swedish colonial story as much as it's an American colonial story. So we're excited about that. The DVD release, we've held off on that until we could develop the television broadcast market. So probably in 2019, we've sort of been waiting for Sweden, I think, to sign on the dotted line. And while I can't give you a hard date, probably sometime in the latter part of 2019. And then we will make it publicly available. We'll put it on an online video on demand service as well.
Our thanks to Kalmar Nicol Foundation Senior Historian and Education Director Sam Heed and R. Kelly Steele for this week's Arts Playlist. The Kalmar Nicol The Forgotten Journey Group was disappointed a bit last weekend, missing out on that Emmy in its category. And stay with us. The Green continues with the latest edition of the A Matter of Facts podcast next. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, has created a podcast, A Matter of Facts, to delve into identifying trustworthy and reliable sources of news and information as part of its mission to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. Delaware Public Media is proud to help produce this podcast, and we also thank the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation for its generous support of this initiative and the Pulitzer Prizes for its partnership. And this week on The Green, we bring you the latest episode of A Matter of Facts.
The Delaware Public School System is charged with educating more than 137,000 children. That's 137,000 individual minds. And in today's fast-paced, endlessly changing social climate, it is a Herculean task to keep up, keep going, and keep trying to remedy some long-standing problems and replicate successful innovations. It should be no surprise that public education anywhere, not just in Delaware, suffers from a bit of an image problem. But does what the public know match the reality? On this edition of the Delaware Humanities A Matter of Facts podcast, we'll answer that question with two who are inside the system, yet still know to look beyond the frame of view to challenge not only the public's perception, but also the status quo. I'm Nancy Karabjanian. Our guests are Shauna Payne, the Delaware Department of Education Director of Higher Education, and Christine Aloyas, the Deputy Secretary for the Delaware Department of Education. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
You know, I'd like to start with you, Christine. You came to the department from the Caesar Rodney School District armed with the frontline knowledge of being a principal. So how did that experience influence your goals for education statewide?
I think that's a great question. So I'm now just starting my second month. I've finished 2 months at the department and 25 years in the Caesar Rodney School District. So I was a principal. I was also an assistant principal, a teacher, a supervisor, a director. So I feel like I've had the gambit of experiences in a school system. And I knew that taking that experience and that passion for what happens right in the classrooms and bringing it to the state level would bring a new, fresh look at how we work collaboratively with our charters and our school districts.
I'll get to what you're doing now in a moment, but I have to ask, because Caesar Rodney, I'm someone who always looks at those rankings and the press releases and everything. Caesar Rodney consistently ranks near the top, if not at the top of the ranking statewide. Does that district have the secret recipe?
So if the secret recipe is always thinking about students first, yes. The one thing that's really important to us is we always look at people, not programs. So I still say we, only being 2 months away from there. The district has always put their efforts into strong professional development for their teachers, a lot of collaboration with the community, and really just making sure that everyone that works in the district is always in classrooms and working and not forgetting why we're there.
Am I naive to think that it can be replicated throughout the state, or is each district so individual that I'm foolish to think what works there could work anywhere?
You know, I actually think it's working in many places across Delaware, and you're correct. You know, Caesar Rodney has had a very good reputation for its performance, and now I'm at the state level and having colleagues across the state over the years, too. There's amazing things going on all across the state of Delaware, and everyone has their own little secret. And the great thing is, working in a small state, we tend to collaborate and work together with that. So, no, you're not being naive. That is definitely possible across the state.
So think K to 12. What is your position now? And now that you're no longer in the principal's office,
right,
what is your position now, and how will that affect that most important section of education for kids?
Well, I'm really excited because the deputy position has been reorganized. The governor, as well as the secretary, really wanted to focus on student achievement as the deputy's main priority. So I oversee our performance management teams, which Shauna is a part of. So we that allows me to be more focused on the instructional piece, hence bringing in someone who has experience directly from a district.
So let me bring in Shauna Payne now, because K to 12 gets a lot of the focus, but your role is really higher education. So tell me about your efforts and how, you know, K to 12, working with that, but thinking also about the next step.
Absolutely. So Delaware is unique, which we love, and we have the Higher Education Office as part of our Department of Education. So that means we really get to serve as kind of that bridge between our high schools as well as our colleges. And so we get to partner with both of them and really identify those issues that students struggle with and areas that should be consistent across every school, regardless of where a student is living or coming from. And so we're focusing in on things like academic achievement once they get to college. Remediation is a huge challenge for our students. Once they get to college, they're finding that they're not quite ready for those college courses, and they're having to take some courses in advance that cost extra money, take extra time. Often for many students can lead to not getting that degree. So how can we partner together to really address issues like that? The affordability issue is always in the news and talking about the amount of debt that students are accumulating. And so looking for creative ways to address that and really trying to strengthen our school counseling teams.
So with it, I believe that at one point it may even still be about 41% of students who go on to college from Delaware need to take remedial courses. Is that a disconnect, or is there something bigger going on?
I wouldn't say that it's a disconnect. So there's two core issues there. One, just in looking as we have more and more students who are choosing that path to go to college because they understand that they need that to be able to access careers as our labor market is changing. Those students are still having some gaps in terms of just their understanding in writing, particularly and in math, some of those basic skills. So they need that refresher. And then there are some students who are coming in and taking those placement tests and not understanding the importance of the placement test. And so they may not really put their best effort forward. And so we see both of those things happening.
So you really have to kind of convince them to think beyond the now, which is not easy with any age of child, and to really think about the possibilities. That's quite a task.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so we're working with our colleges, and we see them across the board looking for ways that they can do better in informing students. They're evaluating the placement tests that they're using and the process of how students are put into remediation and trying to find the fastest ways to get students in and out and into those credit-bearing courses as quickly as possible.
So, Christine, with a goal to open future opportunities through education, which sounds like the right goal for education after graduation, what would be the biggest challenge then in K to 12?
Wow. Well, I think one of the biggest challenges is recognizing the fact that we are starting in K. So this is not something that students and families start to think about when they hit high school. So one of our greatest challenges is looking at ensuring that we have that rigor and that challenge starting in kindergarten, and also that understanding that all students have this opportunity for college and career. So it's working together as a whole system, K through 12, and not waiting until secondary to start thinking about it.
How difficult is it to deal with the changing standards that come out from beyond the state of Delaware, from the national level? Is that something that kind of upsets the so-called apple cart, like my mother would say?
I don't necessarily think that it upsets the apple cart. This is something in education after 25 years, and anyone probably 2 years in will know, education's constantly changing. This is something that teachers are quite flexible, as well as the administrators they're working with. But at the same time, you always have to look at when anything that comes new within the district or the charter or wherever you are, you're looking at it and saying, so how are we going to make this work for us? How is this going to be best for the students that we're standing in front of? So yes, it is definitely a challenge. Education is a tough field to be in, but at the same time, we have phenomenal teachers that take whatever comes at them and use their magic.
So I'd like to get into a bit of the perception issues, because I think that's important to the topic of this podcast. And it seems that the public really only takes in the negative about their public schools. People tend to like to think poorly about their public school in their home community, just like they like to think poorly about their hospital. I need to go to the big major city for my treatment. I need to find the best school because the schools aren't good enough for me. It's one of those frustrations that I found as a parent, because I'm a public school parent at one time, a bit ago, and I don't find that to be true. I mean, public school was the right call for two of my three children, and it really helped. So what causes that? Is it our obsession with rankings? Is that the big problem here?
I would say information. We struggle in this world of technology and social media and access to information that sometimes people get a lot of information and they don't necessarily always know how to put all of the pieces together, and it's also which information is in front of them. But certainly if you walk into any school across the state, you're going to see amazing things happen every single day. We just got a letter from a student the other day who said she applied for 99 scholarships and got so much money that she doesn't know what to do with it. So there are amazing stories every single day across all of our schools. And I think it's, you know, really getting to know, going into that school, getting to know that school community and seeing the whole picture.
So it goes back to what I said, individual minds, absolutely, not just 137,000 plus students. Mm-hmm. They're each little people turning into big people.
Mm-hmm. And I think just to jump off of what was just shared by Shauna, as a principal, I would have parents that would call me that were moving into the area or looking for a school, and they would say, well, I read this, and I would always say, I'll give you one better. Come in. I said, make an appointment, come in, meet with me, you know, see how you feel about the atmosphere of the school, walk through a few of the classrooms. Like Shauna said, you go into any classroom and you automatically know whether that's the best environment for you. So there's just so many great things going on. It just depends where you're getting your information from.
What's your reaction when somebody says, well, you know, students in Japan, blah, 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 blah. Achievement here, you know, in the other country, the far off land. What do you react? How do you react when you hear that?
You know, the first thing I think is my emphasis is on what's happening in Delaware. And there's so much, as you said, that comes at us in the field of education. And there are places that will tout higher performance or different ways that they're approaching education. We have different countries that come here looking at the American education system and what can they do. I think, again, it always goes back to keeping focus on what's best for kids, being engaged in your community, being a positive voice and a supporter for your community and your schools. And that's, you know, when I hear that, I think I know what's going on here, and I'm just going to keep focusing on doing my best for Delaware.
Delaware's public schools, are they in the shadow of this huge, longstanding private school system that we have, of some schools in Delaware that, you know, have really, you know, been a feeder to the Ivy Leagues? Is it difficult to be in that shadow, or is that a shadow you're not even paying attention to?
Well, I'll just speak to it personally as a public product of Delaware Public Schools who went to an Ivy League school. It's certainly possible. Many of our students are able to go to the best in the nation and best in the world and accomplish many things. So I think it's each individual student and what they need at the time, and it's not necessarily the whole system is substandard by any means.
From your earlier comments, Christine, I think I know where you're going to go with this, but I'm asking it anyway. We have charter, and we have private, and we have schools that are really trying different things in our state. Along with our public schools, it sometimes becomes a menu that is difficult for a parent to navigate. But do you believe they can all coexist?
I believe they already are. I mean, that's one thing we were talking earlier. You know, it depends. In one family, it may be different from one child to the next. There's so many different opportunities in the state of Delaware. And again, we're so small. We're always sharing ideas. Just a few weeks ago, all the curriculum directors and charter leads were together in a room talking about curriculum, talking about initiatives moving forward. So, you know, yes, I think they can coexist together. I think that we get great ideas from one another. Of course, there's always some sense of competition from one to the other, but that happens from one school district next to another comprehensive school district, and that only makes you better.
So how do we address those schools that are not succeeding as well as those perhaps in the Cesar Rodney School District or another district in the state? How can the successes be implemented yet still be individualized for whether it be a school in downtown Dover or in the city of Wilmington?
So again, it's teamwork. And there's no better place for that to happen than Delaware. So as we look at the schools, and we'll be identifying schools that need some additional support for this year after last year's test results, through our accountability system, we're also looking at the fact that it's not just test results. We're looking at chronic absenteeism. We're looking at, are they taking pathways? Are they looking at AP classes? We work on that as a team, and through this performance management team at the department, we are reaching out with supports to all of our districts and charters and working collaboratively to replicate where possible. But in some cases, something that works really well in one school may not in another, and we're very cognizant of that. So it's just this continual give and take and willingness to work together as a team.
And I guess people just need to understand that there is a difference between where you are attending school, because every community has its own personality.
Absolutely.
How can you make sure that schools that are succeeding don't then start to slide because of focus or attention on schools that are not?
Well, I think that you would find in the schools that have had the consistent success that they know their needs and the culture and what works, and they're pretty consistent in staying true to that. And so it's just giving them the supports that they need when they need it so they're able to maintain that and not. And often they'll tell you, you know, I only need a little bit. I don't need the hands-on every single day. Just tell me how to access it, and we'll make it happen in our school.
And I think with the accountability model in Delaware, it's a continuous school improvement model. So it doesn't matter where you are on the spectrum. Continuous improvement is the goal. So the supports that are provided to all schools in the state of Delaware, not just our schools that need that extensive support. So I think that mindset is also really important.
So Shauna, when you were here in the Delaware public school system, what was the testing system that you had to use? Do you remember? You look young enough to remember.
It was something California something.
Oh,
test.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. You know, that's something that is interesting as a parent. I mean, the span of my children was 6 years, so I saw a lot of change in what was happening with the testing systems. That was confusing to me. It was also confusing to my younger child who didn't understand. She was too young to understand, thought she was a teenager, but not. But also at the same time, it's frustrating when you get the results back. Because as a community, we don't really have the knowledge to understand why it's high here, it's middle here, it's low there. It seems like it runs the gamut. So what is your advice to understand, whether it be a national ranking or a local ranking, whatever, to be able to understand what's happening within the walls of an individual school?
Well, first of all, being involved in the school. So asking questions. Some parents feel like they don't want to be that parent going in and asking. As a principal, I welcomed anyone to come in, talk to me about what's happening with your child, talk with your teachers, you know, within the community sharing information. Our schools do a great job across the state of having different nights for parents and conferences, and the state is providing an actual communication package that each of the districts will have with more information around Every Student Succeeds, which is Replace No Child Left Behind. Much more supportive plan coming from the federal government. So it's just a matter of just stay involved, ask questions, and people can learn together. Not everyone's always going to have the answer right away, but they'll know who to go to get it. And that's really what builds that capacity.
Does that help to change the narrative?
I think so. I think it's about us working collectively together. We often say Delaware is small enough that we can do it, and that's true. You know, when you go out to other states, they have so many other hurdles that they have to overcome to be able to work together, but we can learn from each other, and it's not a hurdle to be able to go from one district to the next to ask questions or to just get involved and learn more. So I think that it's very possible.
You know, it's interesting. Even the physical look of some of our school buildings has changed. I used to joke all the time that the architect for some of our schools was the same one for our prisons because they were just so unattractive. But now you look at renovations and new buildings that are going up, and they're inviting. You're both nodding so enthusiastically. This must be you must see that as a real positive too, not just me with my superficial eye.
Oh, absolutely. What student doesn't want to feel like when they walk in the building that that building is welcoming? And so having a building that, you know, is light and airy and has all of these, the signage and the art and all of that around there sends a message. And I think that makes a difference in your attitude and how you feel about coming into the building each day. And for the staff too.
You agree?
I absolutely agree. And I think it goes along with the premise that we really need to look at educating the whole child. It's not about walking in and sitting down in front of a textbook for the entire day. There's so much more than just the core content that needs to be learned in school, and having environments that are conducive to learning help in that process.
You sort of have already answered this, but I have to ask because, you know, parents often rely upon the parking lot for communication. And some parents can't even get to the parking lot because of the, you know, so it becomes the bus stop if that is even available for a working parent. Is there a way to bolster that link between parent and school without them having to physically be there? Because that's not always possible.
I mean, I think we take advantage of all of the different technology pieces that we have now. You know, as a student who bussed for 45 minutes one way back and forth, that was always a challenge of being able to get into the city, to be able to get to the school and have that engagement. But, you know, you find ways to communicate and talk to teachers that without having to be physically present. And I think that that's important. And teachers are doing an amazing job of making themselves accessible.
Christine?
And I also think that districts, charters, the department, we've made many community connections. So the more we're working in collaboration with community groups, that message is coming out in other forums also, as well as many schools are out, take buses out in the summer and go into the community or go to different locations where they can meet with their children and families, because that is definitely, I don't want to say it's a problem, it's not a problem, it's just something that needs to be looked at, that not everyone is able to get to the school. And so how do we get out and get that message out there?
All right, I have a couple questions that are just kind of bonus questions, almost a lightning round, I guess you could call it, because I want to know more, because, you know, you encounter so many teachers during your course of the existence as a parent. And if you're not a teacher, you don't have an understanding. So first thing is why education for you? We'll get to Christine in a moment, but Shauna, why education?
Well, I was that kid who tortured my little sister playing school, so I always wanted to go into education. That was kind of a given for me, but really just the passion of wanting it to be accessible for all students. I had vivid memories in school of just seeing that separation and between myself and friends and not understanding that, and really wanted to be able to be a part of changing that to make sure that every student got the same opportunity.
Tell me a little bit about that. You're sitting in a desk, and what was the environment like?
You know, often I was isolated by myself in a classroom for a variety of different reasons, different track, different path, et cetera, and seeing friends and hearing teachers making comments about students who I was riding the bus with, hanging out with, playing in the playground with. And so, you know, just seeing those differences, particularly across economic and racial lines, was hurtful, but gave me a passion to want to be a part of making a difference.
That is something that really has been an endless scar for Delaware since, you know, busing first began and then was ended in Delaware, yet still continues to keep a good balance within our schools. So do you think, if you were to put on a scale, and I hate to go back to numbers, but I have to, of where the progress is in erasing that, 10 being fully erased?
I don't know that I could scale it. I think it's so varied across the state, but we're working towards it. I do think that as a state, we have a heart to move in that direction, and we're going to keep getting there.
So flashback 25 years, Christine, why education?
So I always joke with my family. I think I was born an educator. My father was a high school principal for 20 years, which is unheard of. And my mother was a teacher until like over 60. She went well past her retirement age. So I think I always knew that education was the field. I saw how respected they were in the community. And I don't think people always see that. But as a child and all the people they knew and the people that looked up to them when I would go to my father's events at his school or at my school, my mother taught in the school where I went. I knew that was something that I wanted because I knew they were having an impact on so many people every day.
So Christine, what would be your advice to a parent with a public school child? What is the 2 to 3 words that you would say to them so that they can forge ahead for the rest of the school year with confidence?
Absolutely. Stay involved, as we talked about before. The more involvement, the better. Be the cheerleader. Be that person who's always there, not only for the school, but for the child, and really encouraging them to do their best and showing that you're a partner with them in what they're doing every day. So really, just be a cheerleader and be involved.
Shauna, what would be your advice for a student?
For a student, I would say come with an excitement. Look for those who are cheering you on and be willing to make mistakes.
Did you have somebody cheering you on?
I definitely did. I definitely did. I have still have good relationships with some of my elementary school principals and teachers who were very influential in just supporting me, not just while I was in their school, but even since then. And that made a huge difference.
Do you have an ultimate goal in education?
My ultimate goal would be that every student gets to do what they want to do in their life and that they have the tools and resources and skills to be able to choose that for themselves.
Christine, what's your advice for a teacher? For an educator?
You know, I think for our educators today, sometimes what you started out with, kind of the noise that or the negativity that somewhat comes behind education. I've been in this 25 years. I still have a passion for what I do. This is probably one of the most influential positions you could be in. And to really take that to heart, to always keep the main thing, that was what my mentor told me years ago. Keep the main thing, the main thing. Mm. And I think sometimes in education, a lot of other things come throw at you. And just remember, you're here for the kids. You're having a life-lasting impact on everyone you work with every day.
Here's a question that we ask everybody who participates in our podcast, and it really gets to the fact that the facts aren't always the facts. You know, people can go, there's no such thing as alternative facts. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of confusing information out there. And as we talked about, confusing with education as well. But for you personally, and we'll go to you first, Shauna, where do you go for news? What is your favorite news source that you consider your favorite and your best?
I tend to prefer sources that give me lots of different sources. So I have an app on my phone that just filters all the news in there for the different topics that I'm trying to follow. Because I don't like to rely on any one particular place. I think it's important to see it from lots of different perspectives and to be able to wrestle with it. So whether I'm reading it or listening to the podcast or watching it on TV, I try to keep it as varied as possible.
Favorite podcast?
I was for a while listening to On Rye with Angela One, but I don't think it's been on recently. I haven't been able to catch it. So,
Christine, what's your favorite news source?
So I would say probably about 6 months ago, I said to my husband, I think I need to stop watching the news first thing in the morning. There's so many different things coming at us, and I'm just not sure who to listen to and what to do. And, you know, it sounds kind of crazy to say this, but my best news sources are my colleagues across the nation. And working at a state level, you know, your colleagues are literally other states. You know, it's no longer the district next door or, you know, the school next door. And it's just really listening and collaborating with people across the nation and hearing how similar we all are and the challenges that we're facing and the solutions that we're coming up with. So I have different organizations like the CCSSO and EdWeek and all different places that I get information from, very much like what Shauna said, siphoning a lot. But I feel like the best information I get is right from those that are working directly with children.
All right. Well, thank you both so much. I want to thank Christine
Aloyas.
Aloyas. Look at that. I panicked at the end. And I also want to thank Shauna. Thank you both so much.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
That was Nancy Karabjanian with Christine Aloyas, Deputy Director of Delaware's Department of Education, and the department's Higher Education Office Director, Shauna Payne, on this edition of A Matter of Facts. The A Matter of Facts podcast is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Its mission is to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. We thank the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation for its generous support of this initiative and the Pulitzer Prizes for its partnership. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The interviews and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, A Matter of Facts host Nancy Karabjanian, and Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.